Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Allison Stube, Associate Professor for the Division of Maternal-Fetal Medicine at UNC, about the benefits of breastfeeding for both baby and mom.
This is such an important issue, and one in which I think we make assumptions, and whether they're assumptions about how easy it is, how difficult it is, what the benefits are, what the difficulties are. These are things that we can challenge and learn from, and I'm really excited.
Yes, and Dr. Stube has been just really leading the way for UNC Healthcare, and I'm delighted that we'll be able to talk with her today. But first, we have some research that matters. We are going to talk a little bit about cardio exercise, protecting from depression.
We'll get to talk about salads that you buy that are kind of in those packages that are pre-cut, and is there any worry about those?
About the timing of when you have your baby and maybe impacting being mentally sharper in older age.
And then finally about vitamin D levels. Can they reduce upper respiratory infections in older adults? Let's dive right in, Christy, with the very first one about cardiac fitness and depression. Is this an important study?
Of course it's an important study, and it alludes to much of the research we've talked about together in the past, Adam. This is research published in Preventive Medicine, and it is looking at a meta-analysis of 1 million people who have a variety of cardiorespiratory fitness and then associating that with their fitness levels and their depression and physical and mental health in older age.
And they basically found that low cardiac fitness had a 75% higher risk of depression, and a medium fitness level had a 23% higher risk compared to those that were fit. I did want to put out there that I was kind of depressed, though, Christy, that 98% of these participants were male. Like, okay, we got to do a better job so that we can feel more comfortable that this research extends to women. But I do think that there's every reason to believe it would be generalizable.
Well, I also think that in this case, the fitness levels were not self-reported fitness levels, but they were assessed by how well people did when running on a treadmill, cycling on a stationary bike, or making it up an equivalent of several flights of stairs. And so by doing those objective measures, it does add a little bit to the research showing that, yes, it is, in fact, associated with depression in the future if you have low cardiovascular fitness. Motivating people, I think, to get out there, exercise for your overall wellness, exercise for many, many benefits to your life, but also to impact your overall well-being and mental health.
I like this one study they talked about. It was about college students, Christy, having had some college children in my family, that adolescents, teenagers, young adults who exercise have more self-regulation. I thought, oh, that's a good thing. I wish I'd known about that. When I was in college, I could have exercised even more.
Very inspiring.
Very inspiring. Our next research that matters, I think, is really important, and it's about those pre-cut salads. I don't know if you're like me, Christy, but a lot of times, you know, our family, we're just like running from one thing to another, and you go to the store, and it's like,
no,
okay.
I'm not like that at all.
Oh, yeah, right. but we, you know, we get to the store and it's like, oh, I can get that pre-made salad, or I can like get the 5 ingredients. I know I'm going to pay a little more for the pre-made salad, but it's pre-made. But then sometimes I look at those packages and I see a little bit of kind of juice in there, a little bit of moisture in there. Should I be concerned?
Well, I mean, yes and no. On the one hand, you and I both have been buying bagged salads for some period of time, and somehow we've made it this far. So, you know, maybe not overly concerned of immediate death. However, there is this research suggesting that the process of bagging the salads, of damaging the salad leaves and those little parts of the salad leaves being at the bottom of the bag, and the juices released from those damaged leaves enhance the ability for salmonella to attach to the plastic container and to take root in that bag of salad.
Yeah, this research was published in the journal Applied and Environmental Microbiology. I respect that title. And it really showed that water in the bagged environment can really increase 100-fold when you have this damaged leaves. And I think that, you know, you kind of intuitively know this. When you look at the bagged salad and you see some curled leaves or it's been in your refrigerator, think, oh, can I eat this particular salad? And, you know, you want to pick apart the worst part, wash it real good and do all those things. I think you need to eat it when it's fresher. That's my take home.
Well, I think that this will make me pay a little closer attention to the date on the salad. Maybe if I have time, don't buy the pre-bagged salad. Let's move on to our next research that matters on women and the timing of having a baby and being mentally sharper in older age.
Yeah, this was research that was done by the Keck School of Medicine at USC. And it's really the first study that looks at the age at which the last pregnancy occurred, the pregnancy-related hormones, and then the cognitive function people have later in life. And it was published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society.
Yeah, so, I mean, in some ways, I'm sure we will, Adam, break down some limitations in this study because it is a what we call a retrospective study where they already took people who were age 60 years old and then looked back over their life, adjusted for age and race and ethnicity, income and education to control for those factors, but to then look and see, well, when was the timing of their last pregnancy and how long were they on birth control pills and that sort of thing. The finding that women have better brain power after menopause if they had their last baby after age 35 or used hormone contraceptives for more than 10 years or began their menstrual cycle early before turning 13. All of those things, there's not a whole lot you can do with that information, but I do think that if it's true, it will help calm some of the women's fears. Now that we're labeling everyone after age 35 with advanced maternal age, this can be very scary. What I still consider to be young women. This at least is some other lens to say, okay, well, maybe there are other benefits. You know, this is how life has turned and you're having your babies a little later, but we're going to take good care of you. And then, hey, maybe there's some other benefits down the road.
Yeah, I think, Christy, when we first looked at this, I said, you know, you really have to maintain your cognition if you, because the children force you to. But we think that there are limits to this. We wouldn't say you have your child after age 50 and therefore your cognition stays better into your 80s. And we also know that there are so many other factors that go along with maintaining health that we wouldn't say, oh, we're going to have children or not have children to maintain cognition. That wouldn't be a reason. But I think you're exactly nailed on the head. We should not let women know that if they delay their childbearing years, that there's going to be an ill effect of their thought processes. This research was to say it won't.
Yeah.
That's okay. So, I can live with that.
Exactly. All right. We'll move on to vitamin D. Now, Adam, you and I have talked about vitamin D many times on the show. I don't know how many years ago, but it really became like the vitamin du jour, where we were getting all kinds of different conflicting advice and new studies around vitamin D. This is done by research at the University of Colorado, published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, looking at the effect of high-dose vitamin D on acute respiratory illnesses of geriatric patients.
Yeah, these patients were in nursing homes, so they're very high risk. And we know that upper respiratory infections, exacerbations, worsening of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, pneumonia, these things can really be fatal and often without treatment. And so can you prevent them? And so they took these patients in the nursing homes, 107 patients with an average age of 84, of whom half got high dose of vitamin D, 100,000 units a month. I don't think I've given a patient that dose, maybe one ever, because it's about 3,500 units a day. And a lot of times patients, you may give 1,000 units a day. And 52 had doses up to 1,000 units a day. And they did find that those who got the high dose had their acute respiratory infections cut in half, but they also had a slightly increased number of falls, which is a little puzzling because vitamin D seems to actually help prevent falls for people who are low in vitamin D and are at risk for falls.
Now, this is a preliminary finding, but it's a big step forward in helping think about geriatric patients in nursing homes and trying to reduce infections. So I think more study is needed, but I also really applaud this work and think that we may have really hit onto something here in a way to prevent these kind of life-threatening infections in that population.
Vitamin D could be good for you and me.
Hey.
Well, that'll conclude the research portion of the Maverick Show. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Allison Stubbe, associate professor at the University of North Carolina, about the benefits of breastfeeding for baby and mom. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
You
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we have the great pleasure of talking with Dr. Allison Stubbe, Associate Professor for the Division of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about breastfeeding for baby and mothers.
Welcome, Dr. Stubbe. We're so glad to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
You know, I think the two of us met at an ice cream shop originally when you first came back in this direction for faculty, and both of us had young children and were talking about the benefits of breastfeeding. One of us was probably breastfeeding a child at the time.
That's right. I think that sounds about right.
And it's been great to see you both personally and professionally making such a difference in the world of breastfeeding in helping us become a mother-baby friendly hospital and really making such differences for our patients. So we are thrilled to have you with us to share some of your work today.
Well, I am excited to be here. And I think that the really critical part of all of this is that we need to make sure it's easy for families that want to breastfeed to do it. Too often when we think about breastfeeding, it's perceived as that we're sort of yelling at mothers and telling them they should do this. And moms know that breastfeeding is good for moms and babies. What we need to do is make it possible for more women to be able to meet their own breastfeeding goals.
You know, before we dive into this topic, and it's a really critical, important topic, help us understand a little bit about yourself and how did you get interested in this topic, both your role in going to medical school to become an OBGYN, as well as to do an area of research around breastfeeding?
So I have always been interested in women's issues and women's health. And when I went to medical school, I enjoyed all my rotations. I got to the end of my third year and had narrowed it down to general surgery, OBGYN, family medicine, or pediatrics, which is not very narrow, as you know. But the Venn diagram of all of that really overlaps in OBGYN. I get to do surgery as I would in general surgery. I get to take care of moms, and I get a little bit of time with babies, particularly doing breastfeeding medicine. And then my first child was born the night before the match when I was a fourth-year medical student. So I started my internship with a three-month-old and with a breast pump on my back as I went to my first day of orientation. And I soon discovered that it didn't take much to know as much as anybody else in the medical world about breastfeeding because there's so little focus on breastfeeding training in medical school and in residency. And so I became a little bit of a local expert, and I enjoyed that and got more interested, and things just kind of went from there.
Well, it's fantastic. We've talked several times on the show, so our listeners hopefully are aware of many of the benefits of breastfeeding. And you have shared those in our hospital by really promoting early breastfeeding, even early breastfeeding right after a C-section. Give us a little primer for our listeners of some of the benefits that were known for benefits for children about breastfeeding and about early breastfeeding in particular, and then we can move on to talk about some of the new discoveries.
Sure. So I think that one of the key pieces is that having babies start out breastfeeding in that first hour of life drastically increases the chance that they and their moms will be able to keep breastfeeding going. So when we look at randomized control trials of putting babies skin to skin with their moms right at birth versus taking the baby and wrapping it up and putting it in a crib, we know that in a meta-analysis of randomized trials, those kids who went skin to skin breastfeed 6 weeks longer than those kids who are put in a cot. And that's not the crunchy moms wanting their baby skin to skin versus the moms who say, ooh, gross, wash that off, I don't want to touch it. It's in randomized control trials. So when we put babies right with their moms, we help them get breastfeeding off to a good start. We also make their blood sugars more stable. We make their respiratory rate more stable. Basically, newborn mammals are supposed to be with their moms, and our medical practice has been to separate moms and babies, but that's actually not good for babies, and it's not good for moms.
It's so unbelievable how that's revolutionary in the medical world, that separating the moms and the babies became normal at some point. And then you, at least in our local area, and I know many people nationally, have really made such an effort to change that back to what seems right. And that there's data to support it. Did you get some opposition?
So I think it's always hard to change the way people do things. And there's a lot of stuff that has to get attended to in that first hour, and there's a lot of paperwork, and the babies need to get a shot of vitamin K, and they need to get their eye drops and to get weighed, and there was a baby nurse who would sort of swoop in and do all those things, and then would go back and do another job, and it was disruptive of the baby nurse's checky box list if the baby was on mom instead of where the nurse could sort of get that all done efficiently. So we've had to sort of change the mindset and say that Raylene Phillips, who's a neonatologist from San Diego, likes to say that this is a sacred hour, and we wouldn't interrupt a wedding, you know, for somebody to take a telemarketing call. And we shouldn't interrupt skin to skin for a task that's not absolutely essential to mom and baby. So we've made a ton of progress at UNC, and I think that's increasingly become standard of care. In the operating room, it was really interesting. It was our neonatologists who came to us and said, our babies at risk for low blood sugars need to be skin to skin. So you all need to make this happen.
Wow.
And having the intensive care neonatologists who are, you know, the most knowledgeable about high-tech interventions recommend such a low-tech and physiologic solution really, I think, drove us to say, oh, wow, we really need to do this. So it was really exciting to have them come forward with that. They just presented work at the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine showing a drastic decrease in the number of term newborns admitted for hypoglycemia to the NICU, partly as a product of this routine skin-to-skin.
You know, one of the things I remember when I was a fellow and I had just come to University of North Carolina, one of my colleagues who was also a fellow, a pediatrician, said, Adam, do family doctors ever do anything around breastfeeding? And I was like, well, yes. Why do you ask? Because, well, I know the pediatricians, we take care of the babies when the baby's born, and the OB-GYNs do it beforehand. What do the family doctors do? I was like, well, we kind of scanned that whole spectrum, but it led to this research project we did together where we surveyed nationwide family doctors about their knowledge, their attitudes, and their reported counseling. And we found just what might be expected, but if you didn't know a whole lot about the benefits of breastfeeding and your attitudes weren't so supportive, you were less likely to counsel. Have we made progress with health professionals? Because this was a huge red flag that we needed to have curricula for training providers who see women to counsel about breastfeeding.
So I think we're making some progress. The Laurie Feldman Winter, who's with the American Academy of Pediatrics, led a development of a residency training program that was designed to be for pediatric family medicine and obstetric residency trainings. And they rolled it out at multiple sites, and they developed a curriculum, and they found that it was effective. And there was one pre-post study that looked at breastfeeding rates in the clinics affiliated with a hospital before and after the residents did this program, and found that the rates did go up when the residents actually knew something about breastfeeding, which is good. I would hope that would be true, but it's always nice to see these things pan out. But I think you point to a really important issue, which is that there is a sense that breastfeeding is something that, you know, you learn because you did it or your partner did it, and that's where a lot of physicians get their reference from. And we would never say, well, my mom had chemo, so I'm an oncologist. We would expect that you have to learn how
there's a skill set.
There's a skill set. And I think that because people end up reverting to their personal experience, they end up giving advice that isn't necessarily based in evidence, and that often has kind of an emotional grip to it that makes it not helpful for the patient.
Can you give an example of something that comes
to mind? You know, I think that there was recently a paper study looking at the experience of pediatric residents who were breastfeeding, and the title was something like dismayed, horrified, and it was three very pejorative words, and I can't bring them to mind just this moment. But residents weren't allowed time to express milk. They were not supported. They had a terrible experience. And I think a lot of physicians come out of that and say, I wanted to breastfeed, I couldn't do it, I felt terrible, so I'm going to tell my patients, don't worry, it's not that important, because then they won't feel bad. And I think it's really hard because everyone has personal experience. Many of us have been mothers or fathers, all of us have been babies. So we all have an infant feeding story. And it's very difficult to step away from that story and talk about this the way one might talk about some other issue in medicine, like you have hypertension, which medication should we start you on?
Well, and similarly, even in a department where we have lots of experience and we're well known for our maternal and child health care, when I was a junior faculty and had to breastfeed, it was just breastfeed at lunch. There was no one had done that as a working mom in so long that it required us to make new policies and really forge the way for staff, nurses, physicians, residents, everyone to be able to pump during their workday and change some of those things. I know you've been really supportive of that across multiple departments. We're going to need to take a little break. but I'm so excited to talk about breastfeeding with such a national expert such as yourself. And we're excited to come back to talk about some of the benefits, not just to babies, but to moms. We're going to take a break, but we'll be right back with your health.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Allison Stube, Associate Professor for the Division of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about the benefits of breastfeeding for baby and mom. And Dr. Stube, you've just published an important research paper in maternal and child nutrition. Tell us about this research.
So this was a multidisciplinary team project. Melissa Bardick from Cambridge Hospital was the leader of the project, and we wanted to estimate the population health impact of what the world might look like if all moms were enabled to optimally breastfeed. Well, actually 90% of moms is how we sorted it. So the kind of hypothetical was, if a group of women born in the same year were able to breastfeed 90% of the time for 6 months exclusively for each child, and then continue for a year for each child, what would the health of those mothers and those children look like? So doing this was a real team effort. We had to look at all of the evidence on associations between breastfeeding and child health, and then the evidence on associations between breastfeeding and maternal health. And then we built a computer model that essentially simulated a population of women beginning when they were age 15 and following them through age 70. And using population data, they had babies, and their hypothetical babies were breastfed or not, and they developed health conditions or not. And then we counted up the outcomes across that population.
Fascinating. So you had to bring together all kinds of statistical experts and people to model this out for you. Give us a sense of how that team functioned and then some of your findings.
So the first step was to look at the literature and decide what studies to use and figure out where the evidence was really strong and where the evidence was a little bit less clear. And then we had to figure out what the current rates of these diseases were and understand how to model that. So there were a lot of Excel spreadsheets and a lot of late nights involved. But what ultimately came from it, which was really fascinating, is that actually from a cost and lives saved standpoint, enabling optimal breastfeeding would have a much greater impact on mothers than on children. And when you think about the maternal health outcomes that are associated with breastfeeding, we know that moms who breastfeed have lower rates of breast cancer, of heart attacks, of hypertension, of diabetes. And those are big, costly diseases that are among the leading killers of women. So it's not entirely surprising when you think about that, but it still was very different from the conventional wisdom, which is that moms should breastfeed because it's good for their babies, and if they don't like it, they should just suck it up because their babies need it. This would argue that helping moms breastfeed is good for moms, and therefore, as a maternal health issue, as a feminist issue, we should make sure that every woman who wants to breastfeed is able to do so.
Take us then through, what do you do with this research as the next level? Because clearly this impacts not just decisions of patients, but providers, potentially health insurers, policymakers. Walk us through some of this implication.
So I think the impact really needs to start with policymakers. So if we think about every other industrialized country on earth, there is some kind of paid maternity leave provision. In the US, there is no paid maternity leave. And we know that 23% of employed moms are back to work within 10 days postpartum. Mm. It's really hard to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months if you're at work on postpartum day 11. Mm. But that's one in four employed women in this country. So one of the first issues we need to think about is, what are the big systems drivers that make it difficult for moms to achieve their own breastfeeding goals? And I think I would start with paid leave as a critical one. And there's clear evidence that in states that have implemented paid leave, breastfeeding rates have gone up. We also know that paid leave is associated with lower infant and child mortality. So this is a sort of a no-brainer from my perspective. And if breastfeeding can help to push that no-brainer forward, that's awesome. I think on a payer level, it speaks to the importance of easy access to breastfeeding support for moms, because this isn't something that's easy for everyone. It's easy for some people, but I don't seem to know those people. I like to tell patients it's a little bit like learning to ride a bike. In the beginning, there's some crashing and burning involved, but then if someone's running along behind you and balancing and encouraging you and helping you get back on, it becomes easy, but that takes some time. And although the Affordable Care Act requires coverage of lactation consultant appointments, that isn't operationalized very effectively. That lactation consultant has to be in network, and which ones are is unclear, and there's a whole lot of paperwork that makes that not a real thing for moms. So we need to make it easy for moms to get support when they run into trouble. And then I think providers need to own support for breastfeeding the same way that we own support for pregnancy. I was speaking at a conference in Oregon last week, and I struck up a conversation with a young man who was a graduate student. He said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Oh, I'm an obstetrician. I focus on breastfeeding." And he looked at me and said, "Are those things actually related?" And I kind of head smacked. It was like, "Well, don't the pediatricians do that?" And I said, no, the breasts are attached to mom.
Maybe it's the same person who talked with me about my research 2 decades ago.
Exactly.
Well, he was like 25, so I don't think he was in that conversation 2 decades ago. And he was a smart guy. He'd gone to MIT. Like, he wasn't dumb. But I think in obstetrics,
there's an implicit bias that we have about our own attitudes towards breastfeeding.
But it just happens. Like, you don't need a doctor for that. And pregnancy just happens too, but we recognize it doesn't always happen smoothly and we need to have some help along the way. So in ACOG's recent clinical opinion on breastfeeding, they explicitly stated that breastfeeding is a core part of reproductive physiology and it is part of the work of obstetricians. And I hope that that statement becomes a reality. So I think that'll help as well.
Well, I think, you're finding, and I want to be sure we say this out loud to our listeners, the finding that suboptimal breastfeeding was associated with more than 3,300 premature deaths in the U.S. each year, and that suboptimal breastfeeding costs our nation $3 billion in medical costs, $1.3 billion in indirect costs, and $14.2 billion in costs related to the premature deaths. And then the fact that the majority of the excess death and the excess medical costs were maternal, I mean, that really should at least capture our attention, if not for concern for moms and babies, but also for getting the payers to really rethink the investment in breastfeeding. What are your next steps in terms of approaching those payers and your next steps in changing the world?
So I think the paid leave issue is critical, as I've mm-hmm. already mentioned. And then I think to some extent the kid costs are immediate. And so while the maternal costs are greater cumulatively, mm-hmm. a private payer will say, well, by the time she has a heart attack, she won't be on my insurance plan, so whatever. And so I think we can take the kid costs, which are going to happen, the kid's going to get the ear infection within 3 months of birth.
Right.
And we've already, others at Carolina Global Breastfeeding Institute have taken the data on kid costs to the state to get Medicaid coverage of lactation consultants. And that policy is close to coming out, which I think will be
Wonderful.
A huge step forward. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things that I think we can approach. I do think that this is really about population health and not about individual moms. And I see a lot of moms who struggle and have such a difficult time with breastfeeding. And they say, oh my God, my baby's going to get leukemia if I don't do this. And on a population level, if 90% of moms were able to breastfeed, we'd have less leukemia. But the chance that one mom for whom breastfeeding is a nightmare and she doesn't breastfeed is going to cause her child to get leukemia is minuscule. And I think that's really important because moms shoulder so much of this responsibility when in fact it's largely a system that doesn't support moms to breastfeed, not
exactly.
an individual mother's lack of willpower.
So is there any role for incentives? You know, I think about we use incentives sometimes to change an unhealthy behavior, but it seems like if there were an incentive that helped encourage this, and I don't know if it's an incentive for an employer, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be the individual level. Do we know anything about that might help?
You know, it's a really great question. I know in the UK, there's a study of cash payments for moms who breastfeed. And there was a lot of uproar about whether this was coercive and whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. And the authors said, you know, we do it for other things. We've got to study it. And I don't believe that the results of that study have come out, but it generated a lot of concern about whether this was a good or a bad thing. I think that on the employer level, there certainly seems like there'd be opportunities for incentives, whether that's rebates or on taxes or other kinds of incentives to say, if you go above and beyond the minimum requirements to accommodate your employees, that would be a plus. And then I think for healthcare right now, the Joint Commission measures the rate of supplementation of breastfeeding infants in the newborn nursery, and that's reported as a quality measure. And so that's an incentive of a kind.
Yeah.
Well, and that should carry into our outpatient practices
right.
also, incentives for providers to document counseling and support and resources for breastfeeding.
Well, and one of the big problems is there's no CPT code for lactation consulting.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it hard to bill for. And it also makes it hard to track whether frequency of getting that CPT code.
Well, that's an incentive right there that we should be able to fix.
So I think if we can put in mechanisms to measure, and we don't measure, I mean, you think about meaningful use in the EMR, we're required to ask about smoking at every single visit. But to my knowledge, there's no requirement to document whether a baby's breastfeeding or not at a pediatric visit. And so we can't measure how different practices are doing. So at the risk of someone coming after me for suggesting another meaningful use measure, put it out there that if we don't collect data, we can't measure things.
And I think from your mouth to CPT code.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's what needs to occur.
That's right. Well, we are so grateful if we could carry on this conversation for quite some time. So we'll just put a bookmark in. We'll have to have you back after your next big discovery. But we appreciate the time that you've taken with us today and for all the great work you're doing to support moms and babies in breastfeeding.
Well, I'm delighted to be in Chapel Hill doing this work. So thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Allison Stube, Associate Professor of the Division of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about the benefits of breastfeeding for baby and mom. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question or want to share a story, we would love to address that on an upcoming show. And we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today.
As cold season hits its stride, how can you tell when it's time to see your doctor about your symptoms? When should you consider that you might have a sinus infection rather than a viral cold?
Good question. And I think, you know, it seems intuitively easy, but it's not obvious. I mean, it's like, oh, well, see your doctor when you're sick. But that's not so easy to always determine.
Well, and also sometimes people come in to the doctor and then if it's more of managing symptoms, which it is often with both sinus infections and viral colds, and there's not an antibiotic needed, then sometimes patients will feel like, oh, well, I came for nothing. And in fact, sometimes coming to get checked out and getting that reassurance and having some assistance with your symptoms is worth the visit.
I'm going to tell you the things that are essential to do and the things that we don't think are as essential. The first thing is, take care of the pain. If you got some pain and your discomfort, you can take some acetaminophen, some Advil if it's safe for you to use that. Help get your pain done. If you have a cough, there's some evidence that this medicines that have dextromethorphan, it's a cough suppressant, work better than things that don't. That guanfenzin probably doesn't do anything, but it may not hurt you. And then you can take one of these short-term saline decongestants or a nasal decongestant. They'll help just a little bit, but not over a period of more than 2 or 3 days.
So the bottom line here is it's tricky to know when you feel bad. It is hard to know when is the right time to go to the doctor during the flu and cold season. But I'd encourage you, if those over-the-counter and initial treatments aren't working, or if you're feeling so bad that you're just not sure, it's worth going in and seeing your doctor, getting checked out. Some help with your symptoms and some reassurance is often worth that visit.
Yeah, green and yellow stuff, it can happen for a few days. If it's lasting longer than a week, maybe time to go see your doctor, particularly if you've had chronic sinus infections and it's getting worse rather than better at that point in time.
And we need to move on, but I do need to reinforce that we used to always give antibiotics for sinus infections. And in fact, the recommendations now state to not give antibiotics for most sinus infections. So it's important just to know that those practices are changing for doctors who are following the evidence.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My wife constantly tells me to stop cracking my knuckles. I don't think it's a big deal. Who's right?
Can
you hear him do it?
Oh, that feels so good. Yes.
Ouch. Oh,
I shouldn't be cracking my knuckles, Christy.
No, you know, it hurts.
It's like putting the fingernails down the the blackboard.
It really
I didn't know that.
Me.
Okay, no, I won't do that
we're
anymore.
Good.
But the real question here is, does the popping of the knuckles, the cracking of the joints, are you going to develop arthritis?
Well, I am so excited for you to share some of what you found about this, particularly with a very important scientist. But the bottom line is that in a study that looked at this, there was no relationship between cracking of the knuckles and developing arthritis. My husband will be very glad to hear this news.
Yeah, 2011, 215 people. But more importantly, we actually have a different experiment by a medical doctor, Dr. Donald Unger, who apparently cracked the knuckles of one hand every day for 60 years and didn't crack the knuckles of the other hand and didn't form arthritis in the one. So this particular case report got him a Nobel Prize, but it was the IG Nobel Prize, which apparently I think has like ignominious Nobel Prize, I'm told, but I don't know, a parody about unusual or trivial achievements in scientific research. Frankly, I find that really useful. I think it's important for scientific research.
It's unusual and disciplined if he truly cracked his left hand every day for 60 years and not his right. Like, that is so intentional that deserves some sort of prize for sure.
It could be a folk belief too, but anyhow.
Okay, let's take our next house call question.
I'm concerned that my mother, who is in her late 70s, is losing her vision. How can I tell if it's a problem and what can I do to help?
Well, first, it's great that you're looking after your mom and that you're starting to think about these things. It is important that you get a comprehensive vision test for her because in your 70s, you know, there could be all kinds of things going on with her vision, macular degeneration, glaucoma, cataracts, other things. And vision is one important piece of preventing falls and of being able to have a quality of life. And so attending to this and getting a full exam is important.
And even if, you know, the initial screen that you may do in your primary care doctor's office is normal, if she's really complaining of a decrease in vision, I would see a specialist at this particular point in time because, again, some of these things may be more difficult. So, for instance, with age-related macular degeneration, really one of the more common causes of ultimate blindness, you can see your central vision. You could read fine print, maybe more difficult, but you might have your peripheral vision still be intact, what you see around there. So it may not be so quite as easy to diagnose, and you may need to look under special equipment to see this. So I agree fully, Christy. Great advice.
Let's take our last house call question. Laura?
My 81-year-old father lives alone. I'm concerned about the possibility of him falling and no one knowing about it. Do you have any advice?
Well, I definitely think that this is a concern. And I'm so glad that you have raised it because I think all of us who have aging parents, we need to figure out how to prevent falls. This is something important to all of healthcare.
Part of your question is about preventing falls. And then the other part of the question is about no one knowing about it. And so those are two very important things to pay attention to. In terms of preventing falls, you can talk with your doctor or physical therapist or other community resources about getting a home safety assessment where someone who's knowledgeable comes into the home and notices things like too many knickknacks on the counter so you can't grab onto something, or a loose rug, or sometimes having a small dog running around can be a hazard. And so being able to point out some of those things from an experienced lens can often help make that home safer for your dad.
There are six components that are really important to strength training that can prevent falls. And I think a lot of times we think of only one or two of these, like gait and balance training, strength training, flexibility, movement like Tai Chi or dance, general physical activity, and endurance.
Especially as we are supporting our parents and loved ones, it's important that we continue to reinforce how important it is. If that strength and gait and mobility and these things have declined, then it's time to reinvest in those things in order to prevent falls. And I also think this element of no one knowing about it if he did fall is important. Part of the home safety assessment could help you with that, but also thinking about an alert bracelet, or also thinking about the appropriateness of being alone at some point. It's important to have an aide or to have other resources checking on him.
Lastly, there's a simple test called get up and go test to help assess, you know, how likely you're going to fall. And you may do it in the office. You may try it with your loved one, but you have them sit in a straight back chair. They get up, don't use the arm rests, stand still momentarily, walk forward 10 feet, turn around, walk back, turn and be seated. And then kind of see how their balance was. How was their transfer? How stable were they walking? And could they turn without staggering? These are the sort of things that you can assess.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. We want you to share your questions, send in your stories, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes, or our health app. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Allison Stube.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.